Mandatory opening narration. Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Okay, so if you're looking for a book, I mean, a real literary experience that will genuinely rewire how you think about things like art, truth, even lies. Well, we absolutely have to talk about William Gaddis.
You really do.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're unpacking his massive debut novel, The Recognitions.
Yeah, massive is the word. And Gaddis, well, he's not just any novelist, is he? He's like a key architect of American postmodernism.
Definitely.
Known for these incredibly intelligent, dense, uncompromisingly complex novels. And The Recognitions, which came out way back in 1955, this is the one that really cemented his reputation, even if, you know, it took a while for people to get it.
Oh, totally. Decades, really. It took Gaddis himself nearly 10 years to write it.
An immense undertaking.
And when it finally came out, panned. Commercially, critically.
Yeah.
Was it just, well, widely misunderstood? Too dense, maybe. Too challenging for readers back then.
Possibly. But then later on, it became this this essential blueprint, like you said, a foundational text for writers like Pynchon, DeLillo, huge figures.
Right. So our mission today, really, is to try and provide a bit of a path through this sprawling, what is it, 900-page beast?
Give or take!
A meditation on authenticity, forgery, spiritual decay. Gaddis holds up this, like, distorted mirror to modern life and asks this really haunting question.
Yeah, the big one. In a world just saturated with copies, with imitations, with lies, what does it actually mean to be real?
And the title itself, The Recognitions, that's a big clue, right? It's an allusion to something much older.
That's right, yeah. It points to the Clementine Recognitions, which is this ancient sort of Gnostic Christian text.
Okay.
It tells the story of Clement, who's a disciple of Peter, traveling the world and eventually, well, recognizing his family members who were lost long ago.
Oh, okay.
So it signals the novel's core theme right off the bat. This difficulty of finding, of recognizing what's truly authentic amidst this, just this sea of fakes. Or maybe rediscovering something true that's been lost.
Okay, let's unpack that central problem then through the main character, Wyatt Gwyn. He's our tragic hero, I guess.
Mm.
A super gifted young painter. Starts out with, like, the purest intentions.
Absolutely. And Wyatt's beginnings are steeped in this profound, though maybe quite restrictive, spiritual environment. His father, Reverend Gwyn, is a strict New England Calvinist minister.
Right.
But that foundation, it's already cracking. The Reverend himself is actually losing his faith, getting obsessed with comparative religion, ancient myths, pagan stuff.
Which leaves a kind of void for Wyatt, doesn't it?
Exactly. A spiritual vacuum right at the center of his upbringing. So Wyatt ditches divinity school, turns to art instead, looking for that sacred quality in, you know, creation.
But he hits a wall, a big one, this paralyzing artistic crisis.
Yeah.
He looks back at the old masters, the Flemish painters especially.
Who saw painting almost as a form of worship, yeah.
And he gets convinced that genuine creation, it's already been done, it's finished. He feels like original art is just impossible now in this corrupt modern world.
It's a deeply fatalistic view, isn't it? He basically argues that the kind of purity needed for true art, the kind the old masters had, is just, well, unattainable now.
Yeah.
Especially when art immediately gets tangled up with money and the market.
The minute commerce enters the picture.
The work is somehow poisoned. Yeah.
And that's the moment his sort of philosophical nemesis steps in. Basil Valentine.
Ah, Valentine. The brilliant, cynical art critic.
He sees Wyatt's talent, sees the crisis, and gives him this fateful nudge. Don't make new art, he says. Forge the old masters.
And the justification Valentine offers is just fascinating. It's key. He frames it not as simple deception, but as artistic resurrection. That's his term.
Artistic resurrection.
Yeah. His argument is basically the original artist was like a priest serving God, right?
Right.
But the modern artist, just a prostitute serving the market.
Okay.
So by forging a masterpiece with absolute reverence, with technical perfection, Wyatt would actually be performing a pure, almost religious act. An act that bypasses the whole corrupt commercial system.
That's an incredible twist. So the only way to achieve purity is through a lie.
Precisely. It's a profound irony at the heart of the book.
And then to make it all work, you know, practically, criminally, enter Reckwell Brown.
Right. The crude, materialistic art dealer. Brown provides the money, the connections, the fake histories, the provenance for the forgeries. He's only interested in the bottom line.
He embodies the very corruption Wyatt was trying to escape, right?
Exactly. With Brown, art just becomes a commodity. a number on a ledger. And the deepest paradox here is that Wyatt's forgeries, they're technically brilliant, they're often emotionally more resonant than the supposedly original contemporary art being made.
So authentic expression in this kind of toxic world might only be possible through this massive deception.
That's the unsettling suggestion Gaddis puts forward.
So we see Wyatt kind of collapsing under the weight of this lie, this artistic contradiction. But Gaddis, he doesn't just keep the focus there, does he? He pulls back the camera.
Right. He shows us that Wyatt's crisis isn't unique. It's actually a symptom of the whole culture he's embedded in, specifically mid-century Greenwich Village.
Ah, the village scene.
Yeah. And Gaddis paints this incredibly sharp satirical portrait. It's a landscape of failed artists, pretentious critics, desperate spiritual seekers. It's hilarious, but also quite brutal. You feel the entropy, the spiritual emptiness.
You mentioned Basil Valentine again.
Yeah.
He really represents the decay within that scene, doesn't he?
He does. He embodies this intellectual cynicism that's so deep it prevents any genuine feeling. He profits precisely because the public can't tell the difference between the real and the fake. It's a sophisticated kind of corruption, maybe even more insidious than Brown's simple greed.
And then there's Otto Pivner. He's a really interesting contrast to Wyatt, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Otter's a crucial foil. Wyatt is grappling with these huge, almost theological questions about creation and authenticity.
While Otto is just trying to get noticed.
Pretty much. Otto embodies the everyday, almost pathetic kind of inauthenticity. He's this aimless wannabe writer, maybe a playwright.
And he literally steals things like stories.
Yeah. Anecdotes, jokes, even bits of personality from people he meets. He plagiarizes life itself, desperately trying to construct some kind of reputation just to feel like he belongs.
So Wyatt's forgery is this grand existential act, while Otto's plagiarism is the cheap, small-time version, like stealing a joke at a party.
Exactly. Gaddis uses Otto to show how this crisis of authenticity isn't just for geniuses like Wyatt. It filters down into mundane, everyday insecurity and desperation. It's tragicomic, really.
And this pervasive lack of authenticity, it affects relationships too, doesn't it? Like with Esme and Esther.
Definitely. Esme starts as Wyatt's muse, sort of symbolizing authentic value, maybe inspiration. But she gets chewed up by the art world's manipulations, eventually descending into drug addiction and despair.
And Esther. Wyatt's wife.
His estranged wife, yeah.
Yeah.
Their relationship highlights the impossibility of real connection when one person is living this fundamental lie, essentially erasing their own self. How can you connect with someone who isn't even really there?
But amidst all this decay and fakery, there is one character striving for something pure. Right. Mm. Stanley.
Ah, Stanley the musician. Yes. He is almost a pure counterpoint. He's trying to compose this enormous sacred organ mass, working totally alone in this old Gothic church.
So he represents that uncompromised artistic devotion, striving for something almost unattainable.
Exactly. A kind of sacred beauty in a profoundly profane world. He's reaching for transcendence.
Now, we should probably touch on the style of the book.
Yeah.
Because it's famously difficult, right?
Oh, absolutely. And deliberately so. The complexity of the writing mirrors the complexity of the themes. Gaddis uses this fragmented structure. It feels almost symphonic, weaving together dozens of characters, plot lines, ideas.
And that dialogue technique.
Yeah.
The unattributed dialogue.
Yes. That's his signature move, really. Huge chunks of conversation with no he said, she said.
It's disorienting.
It is. It creates this feeling of being in a crowded room, overhearing snippets, this cacophony of voices. It reflects the breakdown of real communication, the chaos, the feeling that everyone's talking, but maybe no one's really listening. Just noise.
And all this complexity, this chaos.
Yeah.
It builds towards a pretty devastating climax, doesn't it?
It really does. The plot kind of spirals into this psychological and spiritual disintegration of several characters. Mm-hmm. Wyatt's identity crisis just implodes. He reaches a breaking point and physically destroys his latest forgery, even though it might be his masterpiece.
And then he just disappears.
Essentially, yes. In an act of ultimate self-negation, he abandons his name, his identity, everything. He heads off on this penitential pilgrimage to Spain. It becomes this quest to completely erase the self that perpetrated the fraud.
Is there any hope for him at the end? The resolution feels ambiguous.
It is ambiguous, but there's maybe a faint possibility of redemption suggested. In the very last pages, we find him in a Spanish monastery. and he's meticulously restoring an old painting.
Restoring, not creating or forging.
Exactly. It's an anonymous, selfless act of service to art rather than a self-aggrandizing act of art. Maybe a return to being a humble craftsman, a servant, rather than a tormented master.
Okay, so there's a glimmer there, but then what about Stanley, the musician? His ending is shocking.
It's brutal. Stanley achieves his moment of perfection. He plays the perfect chord, this instant of sublime, pure transcendence on the ancient church organ.
Yeah.
And in that exact instant, the ancient organ collapses and crushes him, kills him.
Wow. So if Wyatt suggests recovery through suffering and anonymity, Stanley's ending feels like the opposite. That moment of pure artistic achievement is just instantly fatal.
That's one way to read it, certainly. It could suggest that pure sacred art, that kind of transcendence, is simply too fragile or maybe too powerful. The corrupted, fallen world just can't withstand it. It shatters itself or the vessel containing it.
It confirms the tragedy then, that the world, bogged down in commerce and cynicism, just can't sustain genuine, uncompromised beauty.
I think it leans that way. And it circles back to that question the novel keeps implicitly asking about the artist versus the art. There's that line. What is it they want from a man that they didn't get from his work? What do they expect?
That's such a perfect Gaddis line. It nails the critique of celebrity culture, right? Focusing on the biography, the personality, instead of the work itself.
Exactly. For Gaddis, the art should be enough. The focus on the artist's life, the gossip, it's a distraction, maybe even another form of corruption.
Okay, so zooming out again, key themes. Obviously, authenticity versus imitation. And that goes way beyond painting, right? It's fake identities, fake emotions.
Everything. And related to that, the crisis of faith. Wyatt's whole journey is like a modern, messed up religious pilgrimage. Conventional religion fails him, so he tries to find the sacred through this profane act of forging art.
And we definitely can't forget the corruption of art by commerce. Gaddis just skewers the art world. How the market values hype, manipulation, marketability over actual merit.
It's a scathing indictment. There's another line somewhere about the power of money being so great that even intelligent people can't resist its pull. It highlights the tragedy that people most committed to authentic values are often the least equipped to handle the commercial realities.
It leaves you with this really profound, kind of unsettling feeling, doesn't it? Makes you question your own compromises, your own little self-deceptions.
Absolutely. And I think the novel's lasting power, paradoxically, comes from Gaddis's own integrity. His refusal to simplify, to compromise his vision for the sake of accessibility. That uncompromising quality is the book's ultimate act of authenticity, in a way.
That's a great point. Mm-hmm. And maybe this story teaches us that real originality isn't just about being different from other people. Maybe, like one quote hints, it's about being different from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Needing that constant, maybe painful self-transformation to get somewhere true.
A constant wrestling with the self. Yeah, that feels right. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.